state, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.
With the 63rd pick in the 2020 NFL Draft, the Kansas City Chiefs select Willie Gay, linebacker, Mississippi State.
Listen, Willie, I think you heard some of the commentators mention that he was a first-round value player. It had a couple issues at the college level, and one of which I, got a little bit blown out of perspective. But we did our homework on everything. Brett did a great job with that. We felt very comfortable taking him at that spot. And also, listen, it helps to have the people in the locker room that we do. With Tyron and Frank, they'll take him under their wing. Hitch, that whole linebacking room is a very tight group. They'll take him in. Make sure he's in good hands there. So, and teach him the right way. He was the linebacker we wanted. And it's kind of weird how it all worked out. We were able to get him. We were kind of holding our breath there at the end, but we're sure glad we got him.
Andy Reid on the Chiefs' second-round draft pick, which is Willie Gay. He was selected on Friday. Linebacker from Mississippi State. Had the second-fastest combine time in the 40. Behind Isaiah Simmons, second fastest as a linebacker, ran faster than some secondary guys. Seems to be a really good value for the Chiefs. The reason that he fell to the second round, he was suspended for academics along with eight of his teammates at Mississippi State last year. And probably the bigger reason, got into a fight in practice and got in a fight with the quarterback. So gave him a black eye from what we understand. He will not be allowed to fight Patrick Mahomes. And if he even tries, he will be kicked off the team probably immediately. So you may say, well, that's a character issue type of guy. Why are the Chiefs drafting him? Well, they're drafting him because of potential. Drafting him on athleticism. They need a linebacker that can go side to side, that can run people down. He's a physical guy, 6'1", 240. So he's actually bigger than Patrick Queen, who went in the end of the first round to Baltimore, and a guy that I would have liked the Chiefs to have picked up, because we know the Chiefs have a bit of a need at the linebacker position, and especially with speed running sideline to sideline. But I like the pick as long as the guy can stay out of trouble. But anybody that wants to make a big deal about him getting into trouble, he had an academic issue. Lots of players have that. And he wasn't the only player suspended from his team. There were nine, so there was an issue there at the college. And then, secondly, the instant he lost his cool, obviously, got into a fight at practice involved with the quarterback. That's, lots of people have gotten into fights in their life. I have gotten into a fight in my life as well. So that shouldn't be held against somebody for the rest of their life, unless, of course, they, it was, I don't know how you want to look at it. Every case is different, so forth and so on. What I'm trying to say is that the Chiefs took Tyreek Hill, and his background was much worse than anything that Willie Gay has done, and there were other teams that were willing to draft Willie Gay. There wasn't a team that said, we're not going to draft that guy. Whereas Tyreek Hill, when he was drafted in 2016, a fifth-round pick, there were teams that didn't even have him, Tyreek Hill, on their board because they weren't even going to touch him. And it's possible the Chiefs could have picked up Tyreek Hill as an undrafted free agent had they rolled the dice on that. So in regards to the Chiefs taking Willie Gay, lots of guys have some asterisks on their record. I don't know enough about the guy personally, but the Chiefs had talked to him, so they're convinced that one of the situations was a little bit overblown. I'm assuming they mean the fight at practice. There are fights at practices that happen quite often. Happens in training camp every year. Guys get sick of seeing one another. So don't know exactly what caused the fight, but I will say that I think you just got to look forward and move on, and hopefully, and Willie Gay, by the way, wasn't charged with any kind of assault or anything like that. It was a football fight, per se. So that's the second-round pick for the Chiefs. Of course, the Chiefs took Clyde Edwards-Helaire, the running back from LSU. Some people have been critical of that pick. I like it because it's a perfect pick for the Chiefs' offense. And Damien Williams going into his final year as a Chief in regards to the second year of his deal. And here's something that was lost on some people, and it's something I kind of roundabout thought about when the Chiefs were thinking about maybe drafting a running back, and that is the Chiefs haven't had a guy that can really get you a big yardage on first down since Kareem Hunt. And then, of course, you know what happened with Kareem Hunt. Now, Damien Williams has done a nice job, did a great job in the playoffs 2 years ago, did a great job last year in the playoffs, but he has not been super durable. He didn't make it through all of last year. He was banged up and ran for under 500 yards for the season, but has some explosiveness, as we know, with a couple long runs. But the Chiefs needed a guy to, one, I think, help carry the load at running back for Damian Williams coming up this year, and then to have a guy to take over as a full-time running back in 2 years, and they'll have a rookie deal, and they can save some money there, and I would guess Damian Williams will be let go after this year. But if he has a really good year, maybe the Chiefs can afford to bring him back. Who knows? But here's what Brett Veach was talking about. This Chiefs offense is already dangerous, and they've been dangerous. They were dangerous, of course, with Kareem Hunt on the team, and then you lose Kareem Hunt midway through Patrick Mahomes' first year as a starter, and I hurt the Chiefs down the line. I think it certainly could have used Kareem Hunt against the Patriots in the AFC title game, but eventually the undoing for the Chiefs was their defense. But the offense, we saw what they did last year. They were so tough to stop in the playoffs, but during the regular season, their offense was kind of up and down at times. They had their spurts where they scored 28 points in the quarter. But you bring in a guy like Clyde Edwards-Helaire, who played against the best competition in America, playing against the Alabamas of the world, the SEC teams, LSU won a national championship. Yeah, he had talent around him. Guess what? He has a lot of talent around him in Kansas City. Here's Brett Veach talking about not third down. We're talking about first down, how first down with Helaire can change how explosive this offense can be for the Chiefs. Are you kidding me? The Chiefs can get better on offense?
You know, you talk about just situational football and down distances. I talked to Coach about this. You know, you look at just running plays and you know, during the course of a game, two-yard carries when it's blocked up. All of a sudden, you get a guy like Clyde Edwards-Helaire and you know, second eights now become second and twos and second and threes. And when you're faced with second and twos and second and threes with Pat Mahomes, I really don't know how you defend that. When you can just take shots on second and two or third and two and third and ones, just because you know, second and twos, second and threes, you can take shots because you know, if you don't get it, you still have third down. So this guy has that ability to win the first down. Always, you know, you want to win first downs and keep the chains moving, put yourself in good down and distance situation. So when you have a guy that can create plays and put you into those second and twos and second and ones, it just makes your offense that much more difficult to stop.
Think about the Chiefs. They had third and long, and somehow they find a way to get a first down. Patrick Mahomes, third and 15 in the Super Bowl, goes deep to Tyreek Hill, changed the Super Bowl. The Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes on third and longs, his QBR is out of this world. His passing rate is out of this world. Now you can't count on converting third and 10, third and 12, third and 15 all the time. Now, suddenly, when you have a third and 10, third and 12, third and 15, the other team knows you're going to throw and the Chiefs still can complete the pass. Now imagine, as Brett Veach said, having a lot more third and threes, third and fours, because you have a guy that can make the first guy miss, as Helaire can, and get you 6 yards on first down, 7 yards, 8 yards. You know, Damian Williams typically hasn't done that for the most part. Williams is good catching out of the backfield, so is Helaire. So I like the pick of the running back Helaire. People said the Chiefs should have waited to the second round to get him. He wouldn't have been there at the end of the second round. Now, could they have traded down and got him in the middle of the second round? Possibly, but you have to have a trading partner in order to do that. So they really liked him, and they picked him up in the first round. Willie Gay, linebacker in the second round. And we talked about, Dusty and I think a lot of Chiefs fans know this, that the needs for the Chiefs, it depends on what order. I think a lot of people thought the Chiefs needed a corner. That was a position they needed most. I didn't really agree with that. Linebacker, to me, was the most important. I needed somebody athletic. As I said, run side to side, can track down guys, speed on the edges, which you're seeing that more and more in the NFL. And the Chiefs are not that fast from side to side. That's why the 49ers, their run plays were stretch plays most of the time against the Chiefs in the Super Bowl. So I thought linebacker was most important. And then I thought the second most important thing was corner, get another corner for depth, because Breland's on a one-year deal and, you know, Ward has done a nice job, but I thought that would make sense, that you need another corner. Then I thought they need depth on the offensive line, and he eventually groom a replacement for either Eric Fisher or Mitchell Schwartz. Schwartz is 30, going to be 31, so probably right tackle. And then probably after that, it was like, well, what is your need? If you keep Chris Jones, you don't have to draft a D tackle. You're okay at the end, it looks like, with Passanow and with Frank Clark and others. You got guys who rotate in. So what's your other need? And the other need would have been running back. So I just told you, in my order, I had linebacker as number one need, corner, number two need, offensive line depth, a tackle or a guard or a guy who could play center somewhere, somebody versatile on the line. And then my fourth was running back. And look what the Chiefs did. First round, they took a running back. Second round, they take a linebacker, which was number one on my list. Third, they took Lucas Niang, a tackle from Texas Christian, banged up a little bit last year, 6'6", 315 pounds. And Chase Young, who was a second overall pick from Ohio State, when they played TCU a couple years ago, they asked him, at, I think going into this draft, who was the toughest guy that he went up against in regards to offensive linemen trying to block him, and he said Lucas Niang of TCU. So the Chiefs got a pretty good value there, and that could be a replacement for Mitchell Schwartz at right tackle. He can play some guard. He might have to play some guard next year maybe, or he's just simply going to be groomed as a replacement for Schwartz down the line or toward Deef if they let him walk. And he's a guy that is pretty mobile for 6'6", 315. So Lucas Niang seems to be a good value in the third round. So they got running back, linebacker, tackle. So what's the biggest need, according to some Chiefs fans? Corner, defensive back. They addressed that in the fourth round. Lajarius Sneed, who played corner his first 3 years and then played safety at Louisiana Tech last year. He had 3 pick-sixes in his career, 8 interceptions. He seems to be a bit of a ball hawk. He has speed, oh my goodness, 4.37 speed as a corner. But he had not a great year last year as a safety, but he said it helped him with the mental aspect of the game by playing safety. And I think that's great that you have DBs that play corner and safety, because now you understand, you know, safety tends to be a little bit more, you need to be a little bit more intuitive in regards to covering zones, areas of the field, whether you're going to play cover two, cover three, if you're going to play man-to-man. And so he has that background, so maybe even play a little safety for the Chiefs, although I don't think they need that. But he's a guy that, you know, good size, great speed. I think it's a pretty good value in the fourth round. Chiefs have had some pretty good fourth-round picks over the years. Jared Allen is one I can think of right off the bat. And then in the fifth round, the Chiefs go with Michael Dana, an edge rusher from Michigan. Did not have a good year last year, but his year before he had 8.5 sacks against Big Ten competition. So maybe he can do something. I don't know a lot about him. And then it traded back into the draft there to get Bopedi Keys, a corner from Tulane. I don't know how much he can help this team. He might be a special teams player, a nickelback. Who knows? Maybe he'll turn out to be a Hall of Famer. It's possible. There have been undrafted players in the past that have become NFL Hall of Famers. So the Chiefs in their draft, they had 6 picks. They took 2 corners, a linebacker, an edge rusher, a lineman, and a running back. It fits their needs. I think it's a pretty solid draft. But it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what Pete Prisco of CBS thinks. It doesn't matter what Mel Kiper thinks. Because at the end of the day, we can't grade this draft until 3, 4, 5 years from now. Here's Brett Veach, GM of the Chiefs, on the day 2 picks.
Certainly, we had our eye on Willie when the day started. He was a guy that we circled. And, you know, because he was suspended and there wasn't a large volume of work this year on his tape, we didn't know where the league would be. We were certainly high on him from the get-go. He ran faster than the secondary guys out there at 4.4. The guy's got tremendous upside. Guy can play Sam, play Mike or Will. So I think he'll have a chance to come in right away and bounce in there at Mike and back bounce in there at Sam linebacker. So in the third round there, sometimes the draft goes in different directions. And, you know, we've had some success with finding some value guys in the third round. And you sit there and you look at Lucas Niang. He's a guy, I mean, shoot, just 2 years ago, he was asked to block both Bosa and Chase Young, did a pretty good job. Guy that can play some guard too. So, you know, we think he can come in right away and the kid is smart and challenge a guard. And then potentially work and develop at both right and left tackle. So two guys that we think have tremendous upside and are both extremely versatile.
So there you have it. Having a guy that can do multiple, play different positions on the line, and that was a need, I thought, for this team, a little bit more depth on the line, and they get that with the 6'6", 315-pound Niang from TCU. So grades for the Chiefs draft, in case you care. Once again, these grades don't mean anything, but a lot of people have picked the Chiefs. Their grade is in the B range. The Denver Broncos picked up a couple of fast receivers in Judy from Alabama and Hamler from Penn State. A guy that I like for the Chiefs in the third round was Lloyd Cushenberry, a center from LSU who can play guard. And he wasn't there at the end of the third round because the Broncos took him. So I think that's a good pick for the Broncos. I would have liked the Chiefs to have got him, but that's okay. We'll trust Brett Veach and Andy Reid. They seem to know what they are doing. The Raiders picked up a couple of fast receivers, including Henry Ruggs in the first round. The Chargers, of course, got their quarterback of the future, Justin Herbert, with the 6th overall pick. Kenneth Murray later in the first round traded up to get him a linebacker, who might have been a pretty good fit for the Chiefs, too. You know, the draft, pretty much everybody in the draft, the Raiders, the Chargers, the Broncos, and Chiefs, their grades, like I said, take it for what it's worth, are all in the B range. Nobody hit it out of the park in the AFC West, but they all did a pretty decent job. The teams that are getting vilified for their draft, the Packers, the Patriots are a couple of teams that are being ripped for not having a good draft. Teams that did really well, the Bengals, the Baltimore Ravens got J.K. Dobbins, which I think is a perfect fit for the Ravens, not a great fit for the Chiefs, so that works out for both. And the 49ers, I think, had a pretty good draft as well, and they traded and picked up Trent Williams from the Redskins, an all-pro tackle. So I think those are a few of the teams that did very, very well in this year's draft. But once again, we won't fully know until years down the line. But Brett Veach, in his short track record with the Chiefs, has had some pretty good pickups when it comes to the draft. And the Chiefs, a couple of offensive players, a skill position and a running back in the first round. Some people think they shouldn't have taken a running back in the first round. You know, he's not going to be running the ball all the time. He's a really good pass catcher. He can pass protect when given more chances to do that. Didn't have to do it a lot at LSU. Played with a great quarterback in Joe Burrow, LSU. Now he gets to play with the best quarterback in the NFL in Patrick Mahomes. So it'll be fun to watch and see how the Chiefs go forward. The Chiefs did pick up 18 undrafted free agents. And according to one person's board, Gil Brandt, former general manager, front office NFL guy, the Chiefs picked up the best undrafted free agent offensive lineman and the best undrafted free agent wide receiver among those 18 pickups. So we shall see. Maybe one of those guys will turn out to be a great contributor for the Chiefs and become a star that we don't even know about right now. So it's just not the draft. There's a lot of other players you can pick up that could turn into really good players. KU represented in the draft. They had Hakeem Adeniji, the offensive tackle. He goes to the Cincinnati Bengals in the sixth round, first pick of the sixth round. Kyle Hinton goes to the Minnesota Vikings. He's an offensive tackle from Washburn, and he went 253rd overall pick. That would have been the seventh round. And Kansas State, first time in 27 years, they don't have anybody drafted. K-State has Nick Kaltmeyer. He signed an undrafted free agent deal with the Dolphins. Offensive tackle, Dalton Schoen, wide receiver with the Los Angeles Chargers. James Gilbert, running back, signed an undrafted free agent deal with the L.A. Rams. Reggie Walker, linebacker, K-State, signed with Arizona Cardinals. Trey Deshaun, lineman for K-State, defensive lineman, signing with the Bengals. And for KU, Azur Kamara, edge rusher for the Jayhawks, he signed with the Dallas Cowboys. And that's a look at some of the players from the state of Kansas moving on to the NFL as undrafted free agents that will try to make their respective teams. Now, the Chiefs, as they move on here, the draft now in the rearview mirror, Brett Veach was asked about what's the next goal or what's your next plan of action. And Brett Veach has said that Patrick Mahomes and Chris Jones are future contract negotiations. Now that the draft is over, we have a window now that we can get together and we have a lot of time. This will be the focus of getting those guys locked up. We're certainly hopeful and confident. So the Chiefs sound like they want to sign Chris Jones to a long-term deal. That concerns me. That concerns me. Mahomes, whatever he needs, whatever he wants, give it to him. I mean, he's earned it, no doubt. Chris Jones, not saying he didn't earn a long-term deal, but who's more important, Mahomes or Jones? I think most people would say the quarterback's is the most important position on the field when it comes to football. Anybody tells you otherwise, really, you might have to question their knowledge on football, because unless you have an unbelievable, unbelievable defense, you can't win a Super Bowl without a great franchise quarterback. And just go back and look and see who they are, or guys that are going to be Hall of Famers, or guys that have been winning the Super Bowls most often. And the exceptions are teams that had dominant defenses like the Ravens and the Buccaneers, and you got to go back to the Bears in 85 for crying out loud. So quarterback, certainly important. Chiefs will take care of Patrick Mahomes. What about Chris Jones? It doesn't sound like he was even on the trading block for the Chiefs to make any moves in the draft. So stay tuned on all of that. Former Kansas Jayhawk and one of the greatest players to play at the University of Kansas, Danny Manning. He'd been head coach at Wake Forest for a while, and Dusty and I talked about this recently, that with COVID-19 and the pinch on the athletic departments and the university's budgets, that you're not going to see coaches probably being fired. You're not going to see teams that are going to, you know, pay a big buyout and then go try to hire a guy, because it's going to take some serious money to get a guy better than the guy you had, more than likely. Well, not so fast. Wake Forest apparently doesn't have any kind of monetary issues. They fired John Curry, the AD at K-State. Remember him? Him and Frank Martin had the falling out. A lot of people still mad at Curry because Frank left because of Curry. Well, Curry is the AD at Wake Forest, and he fired Danny Manning over the weekend. And there's a pretty significant buyout. I don't know exactly how much money it is, but I know it is significant. Let me see if I can find it for you on the buyout. But after six seasons at head coach at Wake Forest, Danny Manning was let go. He had a 30-80 record in ACC, so that's not good. And not going to say that that's the wrong move to maybe move on from Danny Manning, although he's highly respected as a great person and so forth and so on. But this is going to cost the buyout, because for some reason the AD that signed Danny Manning, there was a big buyout for a guy that hadn't really accomplished a lot as a head coach up to that point. Danny Manning's buyout is going to cost Wake Forest just under $16 million. $16 million. Wow. Manning, age 53, his record was 78-111, and they were 13-18 this past season. They finished 13th in the ACC, so none of that is good. Don't get me wrong. Manning didn't have a stellar career as a coach at Wake Forest, record-wise. But the news also comes after Shondi Brown, Wake Forest's best player, opted to transfer from the program last week. So that's also not a good sign. The best season for Manning was when the Demon Deacons went 19-14 back in 2016-17 and made it to the NCAA tournament. So there are talk about East Tennessee State's Steve Forbes, former assistant there at Wichita State, that he could be a replacement for Wake Forest. So we'll stay tuned on that as well. Okay, last night, The Last Dance, episodes 3 and 4 aired. That is the docuseries on ESPN of the Chicago Bulls, their last championship run. Pretty interesting stuff last night. Man, this is good. I mean, this is really, really good. If the next six episodes are anything like the first four, we are in for just an unbelievable treat. And it's a bummer we got to wait a full week for these episodes, but it's also probably good that we spread it out instead of just, you know, it's kind of like going to a buffet and you eat everything on the buffet and then you're miserable afterwards, but yet you're like, that food was good. Or you'd be better off going to, or if you like it, it's like having a, you know what, let me change that. It's like having a big bucket, a huge bucket of ice cream. You know, is it better to eat some ice cream each and every day for 7 days and, wow, that I look forward to eating ice cream each of those days? Or do you just go ahead and eat the whole gallon of ice cream and then you don't have any ice cream the next 6 days? It's kind of like with the docuseries with the Bulls. You know, would I binge watch and watch all 10 episodes if they released them all at the same time? You betcha I would. But at the same time, I'm somewhat grateful that they spread this out, so it gives me something to look forward to watch on TV on Sunday night, because I'm sorry, I'm not a fan of The Bachelor. Not going to watch it. So, the Bulls, their last run. Here's a few things. If you didn't see the shows, I'll try not to ruin anything too much for you, or you might just turn down the radio. I don't want you to, but if you need to, so be it. But the first episode last night focused on Dennis Rodman. And I remember when the Bulls picked up Rodman. And you got to remember, Rodman was hated by the Bulls and their fans, at least, you know, because of he was part of the bad boys of the Pistons. They roughed up Pippen and Jordan and others. And the Pistons owned the Bulls in 89. They beat them. And in 90, they beat them in 7 games. Scottie Pippen had the migraine headache in game 7 in Detroit, which I forgot all about that. So that was interesting. Jordan didn't say anything about Pippen's migraine per se. You know, it is what it is. Although John Sally inferred that the migraine came from Dennis Rodman guarding Pippen. Pippen said, dude, I couldn't even, it was blurry, my vision was double, so forth and so on, and the Bulls got beat significantly there in Game 7 in 1990, first year under Phil Jackson, when the Bulls thought that, hey, we're going to beat the Pistons this year, and they pushed them to the brink, but it did not happen. And so Rodman was on the Pistons, but he wasn't the Rodman that we know today when he was with the Pistons. His whole demeanor and his whole personality changed when Chuck Daly was fired or let go or decided not to come back. I can't remember what it was, with the Detroit Pistons. And Chuck Daly was a father figure, a good friend for Dennis Rodman, who had a rough upbringing. His mom kicked him out of the house at the age of 18, for crying out loud, lived on the streets for a couple years. Somehow Rodman didn't get involved in drugs and alcohol, and we're thankful that he didn't. That came later on in his life. But he became a completely different person when he was traded to the San Antonio Spurs. Then he had all kinds of issues with the Spurs in a short time there. And then the Bulls, they needed somebody for that second run, and they decided to take a chance on Dennis Rodman. He became a Bull, and it worked out really well. But the Bulls knew what they were getting with Dennis Rodman, and it was a unique personality. He was a maverick, kind of like Phil Jackson in his day when he was growing up and through the NBA as well. And so Dennis Rodman, in that final season with the Bulls, Rodman needed a break. And so when Scottie Pippen came back, Rodman asked for a vacation. He said to Phil Jackson, I need to go to Vegas. I need to do something. I need to get away. Phil said, well, I can give you 48 hours. And Rodman's like, well, I'll take it. Of course, 48 hours, Jordan says in the docuseries, we knew he ain't going to be back. Phil, he ain't going to be back in time. He ain't going to be back in 48 hours. Well, to make a long story short, Rodman stayed in Vegas for longer than 48 hours. I think it was like about 96 hours, which is 4 days instead of two. And Michael Jordan tells a story about how he went to Vegas. Jordan himself went to Vegas, found Rodman with Carmen Electra, and she was hiding under the sheets or whatever. If you remember Carmen Electra, she was hiding. She's on camera saying that in the docuseries. And Jordan basically pulls Rodman out of there, says, you got to get back and help us win. You got to get back to work. So it took Jordan, like, how long would Rodman stayed in Vegas if the Bulls didn't go and grab him from his vacation? He came back, and then he was a model citizen the rest of the year, and he was a model citizen up to that point. He just needed a break, and then he took a longer break. Imagine what would happen today if a player of any magnitude decided he gets 2 days off, and he decides to take three or four without permission. How do you think that would go down today? Well, the Bulls back then, Phil Jackson's like, we just had to give him a lot of rope. We just knew that's the way it had to be. And we needed him to win basketball games. And obviously Jordan knew that because he went all the way to Vegas and get Rodman to come back. Just a crazy story. But it is interesting that the Bulls, the fans eventually accepted Rodman because Rodman was a nemesis with the Pistons. And speaking of the Pistons and the Bulls, and I remember a lot of this when I was growing up, but I remember Isaiah Thomas and the Pistons when they did not shake the hands of the Bulls and left the court and walked right in front of the Bulls bench in Detroit. Keep that in mind. That game was in Detroit in 1991. The Bulls had lost in 89-90 to the Pistons. The Bulls, despite being frustrated and losing, especially Game 7 in 1990, Michael Jordan, Pippen, and the Bulls, they congratulated the Pistons on Detroit's home floor. They shook hands with them, so forth and so on, even though it burned them that they lost. 1991, the Chiefs sweep the Pistons, beat them in four. They're in Detroit for Game 4. And the Pistons walk off. And Isaiah Thomas last night basically threw Bill Laimbeer under the bus and said it was Laimbeer's idea. And virtually the whole team just walked off, didn't shake hands, didn't even look at the Bulls' direction, walked right in front of the bench. And it did not come off very good, very unsportsmanlike, especially after the Bulls had done what they had done the previous 2 years with the Pistons. So Isaiah Thomas last night, yeah, this is the best part of the show to me because I remember it as well. And I kind of felt like I think Jordan did. Isaiah Thomas gives this story about how, well, you know, the Celtics the year before, or back in 88, when we finally got by the Celtics, Larry Bird and the Celtics, they left the floor early and so forth and so on. That's just the way it was. The torch wasn't passed like it is today. Well, first of all, Isaiah leaves out an important point. Some of the Celtic players left because that game was in Detroit. And Detroit, that they finally got past the Celtics. So there was concern about fans coming onto the floor, so forth and so on. And so some of the Celtics players left. They did leave a little bit early. But that game was in Detroit. That should be pointed out. Now, maybe they were planning on leaving because they were sore they lost. And Isaiah might be right about part of that. But there's also a conflicting report saying that some of the Celtic players left because they wanted to avoid any kind of fans coming onto the court because it was in Detroit. And then Kevin McHale was walking on the floor, and Isaiah says, I'm the one that grabbed him. And then that's when Kevin McHale said all these nice things. And if you go back and watch the video, it does look like McHale was going to keep walking. So Isaiah makes a few interesting points. So Isaiah Thomas is basically saying, well, that's the way Celtics did it with us. And so that's what we did to the Bulls. The Bulls, though, the Celtic thing shouldn't matter because the Bulls the previous 2 years were sportsmanlike and they shook hands and did everything with the Pistons. So I remember the way that came off. And Isaiah Thomas said the next year, you know, we meant what we did. We did what we did. We meant what we did. There's no regrets there. But having said that, if we were to do it all over again, yeah. Was it unsportsmanlike? Yes. Is it something we shouldn't have probably done? Yes, but at the time, that's how we felt. Jordan obviously doesn't feel too good about that. He's still ticked about it this day, and they showed an iPad to him about Isaiah saying all that stuff. And Jordan right away said, it's all BS. I can watch it, but I know that's a bunch of horse pucky. And then Jordan explained, listen, we didn't want to go shake their hands and be sportsmanlike, but we did the previous 2 years. And so forth and so on. Horace Grant came on and said they acted like a bunch of you-know-whats. And the Pistons did get a bad rap for that. But they were the bad boys, and that kind of lived up to their reputation. So it is interesting. Isaiah now says, well, you know, that's just the way it was in those days. That's what the Celtics did to us. It wasn't to that magnitude. And the Bulls, they swept the Pistons. The Pistons didn't have to worry about any kind of court storming. I can understand if it was game four in Chicago, Isaiah could use the same excuse. Like, listen, we want to get out of there and be safe. But this game was in game four in 1991 was in Detroit, and the Bulls swept them. So I don't really buy it too much from Isaiah. And anyway, that eventually, if you think about it, there was a dream team in 1992, and Chuck Daly was the head coach of that dream team, the first NBA dream team. He had Jordan and Barkley and Karl Malone, and John Stockton got in over Isaiah Thomas. But some people forget about this, is that Joe Dumars might have been the next guy, or maybe could have deserved it more than John Stockton. But there are a lot of people that believe that Jordan made sure that Isaiah Thomas didn't make that dream team in 1992. So I've seen Piston fans that are all ticked off posting on social media last night about how, oh, yeah, well, Jordan did this to Isaiah. Keep in mind what came first. 1989 and 1990, Jordan went up to Isaiah Thomas, shook his hand, gave him a hug after the Bulls lost. 1991, Isaiah Thomas, which was chicken, you know what, walked off the floor with his teammates, didn't show any kind of sportsmanship, and ignored them and went off before the game was over and didn't shake their hands, acknowledged that the Bulls had beat them. But the Bulls did that the previous 2 years. So then 1992 is the dream team, which is the year after. Jordan's still sore about it. Now, Jordan and the dream team say that Jordan didn't keep Isaiah off the team. I don't buy that either, okay? Because I'm pretty sure Jordan's like, listen, I ain't playing if Isaiah Thomas going to be on this team. I'm not going to be a part of the dream team. And the dream team was like, listen, we want Jordan. We don't want Isaiah. But if we could have both, great. But, you know, we can go with John Stockton. That's okay. So there is a really bad relationship there. I mean, Jordan and Thomas don't like each other. Isaiah Thomas said the other day he's questioning the greatest of all time status for Michael Jordan. Now, there's not many guys back in the day that played in that age that questioned Jordan being the greatest of all time. Okay, that's usually a battle between different eras, like the youngsters now that grew up with Durant and LeBron. And so Isaiah Thomas doesn't like Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan definitely doesn't like Isaiah Thomas and called him a you-know-what. It was interesting. And you knew this all along. And so when you sit here and you get all mad about Jordan keeping Isaiah off the dream team, is that callous? Is that kind of childish? Yeah, probably so. Two wrongs don't make a right. I've heard that before. I would tend to agree. But just keep in mind, Isaiah Thomas, he cast the first blow in that relationship because it was all good in 1990. But in 1991, when they walked off like that, Jordan has never forgot that. And he doesn't like the Pistons to this day, and he hasn't forgiven the Pistons and Isaiah for that. And there's no doubt, then a year later in the Dream Team, there's no doubt that hurt Isaiah Thomas's chances of being on the team. I don't know how you can think any other way. So that was interesting stuff last night. The other interesting thing about the docuseries was that there's a K-State connection. Of course, Tex Winter was a coach there with the Bulls and eventually later on with the Lakers. And Phil Jackson was hired by Jerry Krause when they were getting along. Doug Collins, what happened is Doug Collins was the head coach and Tex Winter was an assistant, and Jerry Krause and the Bulls, they wanted them to involve more players on the team sharing the basketball. Doug Collins basically gave the ball to Michael Jordan, let him go one-on-one. Jordan scored a lot of points, didn't win a championship that way. And so Jerry Krause had Phil Jackson, he hired him. Phil then worked closely with Tex Winter learning the triangle offense that Tex Winter made, you know, was awesome in college, of course, and terrific coach and Hall of Famer from Kansas State University and coached the Wildcats. And so Phil was just assigned to Tex Winter to learn the offense. And then Doug Collins would just not want, he was stubborn. He didn't want to go with that offense. So eventually Phil learned it well enough, and Jerry Krause fired Doug Collins after the Bulls made it to the Eastern Conference Finals in 1989, which doesn't happen very often. You fire a coach when you go that deep in the playoffs. Hired Phil Jackson. And along with Tex Winter, they incorporated the triangle offense that made Pippen a better player and made Jordan share the ball. And eventually, of course, that helped them get over the hump to winning championships in 91, 92, and 93. So there is a K-State connection, big time. And Tex Winter, of course, a Hall of Famer, being a big part of the Bulls' success. Another thing that stood out to me, 1989, when the Bulls finally got on the map with Jordan winning a playoff series over the Cavaliers in game five in Cleveland. And you remember that play by Michael Jordan where he rises and fires, double clutches, and beats the Cavs on a jump shot at the top of the key there, in the free throw circle over Craig Elo. A lot of people forget about this. I had as well. Craig Elo was a decent defender, but he wasn't a great defender. Ron Harper, who later joined the Bulls for their second three-peat run, he was a fantastic defender. And Jordan said last night on the series that, listen, Elo should have never been guarding me on that final play, the buzzer beater to win the series in Game 5 that propelled the Bulls all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals that year. And Ron Harper, he only had about a five-second cut last night. But it was one of the most powerful cuts of the whole series last night, no question. And that was, I told Coach, put me on MJ. MJ said Ron Harper guarded him the best of the Cavaliers. And Lenny Wilkins, a Hall of Fame coach, Lenny Wilkins, said, no, Elo's going to guard him. And Harper's like, whatever, bleep this. And then what do you know? Jordan hit the game-winning shot, ended the season. Sometimes the players do know a little bit more than the coach, or sometimes the coaches make mistakes. And certainly Lenny Wilkins, a Hall of Famer, made a mistake there. Although maybe Jordan would have hit that same shot over Ron Harper. We'll never know. So just a little piece of history. So the docuseries, The Last Dance, will continue coming up this weekend on ESPN. All right, we are joined now. Coming up in just a moment, we start Coaches Week, one-on-one chance with coaching greats from North Central Kansas. Here's our schedule. Tomorrow, Roger Barta, former Smith Center head football coach, will join us, talk about his Hall of Fame career. Andy Nemchek, Beloit Wrestling head coach, will join us Wednesday. Thursday, Mike Weatherman, former head coach of Sylvan Unified and Sylvan Lucas. And Friday, Kirk Christians, former head coach of St. John's Tipton Lakeside. We'll have another Coaches Week coming up in the future as well this spring. So without further ado, John Bingesser is our first up on our Coaches Week, former head coach of Sacred Heart, Beloit, and St. John's Tipton.
Welcome back on the Sports Ticket here on Katy Country 94, katycountry94.com. We are pleased to be joined by one of the most well-known names here in sports, high school or otherwise in the area, and John Bingesser. And John's still going at it, doing some things in senior games and things like that, still participating in sports to this day, even after retirement from coaching and a very successful career at all levels. John, first of all, thanks for taking the time to be with us here. I want to know, really, at the start of this, let's start chronologically, like how you got involved in sports and how you got interested in it. And, you know, growing up in Little Cocker City, Kansas over here, what were some of the things that led to your initial love and want to be active in sports?
I guess when I was old enough and it was time to start Little League Baseball, my dad took me to practice, and that was the beginning of it. I enjoyed the sports, especially baseball during that time, and then on up through grade school and high school, participated in the other sports, football, basketball, track, and baseball.
So then you go from there. What are some of the things you remember maybe about the high school career? Because it was just Cocker City High School back then, wasn't it?
Yes, okay. Cocker City High School. We had good teams every year. I think one year we went undefeated, and most all the other years we were way above 500. So I had a good experience in football. And then in basketball, I started as a sophomore for 3 years, and we had good basketball teams. And then in the spring, we did both baseball and track. So I was involved all throughout high school in sports.
How was the balance back then of playing two sports in the spring like that? Did anything conflict, or did they just make sure everything was, you know, laid out the right way where you could do both of them?
It was pretty easy. I don't remember any major conflicts as far as track meets and baseball games goes. Maybe it was scheduled that way. I don't know for sure, but still, we got along fine doing that.
So from there, then you end up going to Washburn there in Topeka, and participate. It's wild to think about this in this day and age, that you can participate in four different sports at a university or a college at that next level. But that was something that, you know, if you had success, you were able to do that back then. Graduated in 62 from Washburn. But take me through the process maybe of how you get from Cocker City, the small town, to Washburn, and then playing college sports at Topeka there for the Ichabods.
Okay. During my senior year in high school, I had planned on going to Kansas State. So I went up there and enrolled already in Kansas State. And then towards the end of the summer, after American Legion season, I played for Osborne American Legion, I moved up to the Osborne semi-pro team, and we were playing in a tournament at Stockton, and I had a good game with them. And after the ball game, a guy comes up to me and he asks if he could talk to me. And he hands me his card, and it says Scout, Brooklyn Dodgers. Wow. And I got excited about that.
Yeah.
And then we went over in his car, and he visited with me for about a half hour. And he was also the baseball coach at Washburn University.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me down for a visit there, and the rest is the history. I signed up, went to Washburn, and don't regret a minute of it.
And we'll talk a little bit more about your Washburn career there. But was baseball basically what you wanted to do, first of all, or did you not have a preference?
Well, baseball was, because up at K-State, I would have played baseball mm-hmm. up there, but they didn't have, well, they had one scholarship for freshmen, and it was split about two or three ways. But it ended up down at Washburn. I had a full scholarship for all 4.5 years I was down there.
So again, at Washburn, and I want to go back actually to the semi-pro thing, because I was reading your bio on either the Kansas Acacia Hall of Fame or the Washburn Hall of Fame, but it said you once were a teammate of Satchel Paige. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I was playing for the Salina Blue Jays, and Satchel played with us. One of the managers of the Blue Jay team knew him and contracted him to come out and pitch in so many games.
Mm-hmm.
And he played 2 years with the Salina Blue Jays, and we would barnstorm around these small towns, and he would pitch two or three innings, and that was it. And we had a great time with that famous legend.
I remember my dad saying that, I think he was in Waukini one time, and he saw him back there when, you know, I grew up back there out west. What are the best Satchel Paige stories, I guess, you could tell from that time? What's the biggest memory that sticks out from that time for you?
Oh, I don't really know. He's just an easygoing guy.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go over to his apartment there in Salina when I was living there and playing with the Blue Jays. He'd just sit around in his T-shirt or undershirt and just slow motion, seemed like, all the time. And then I think I remember one of his sayings, don't look back. Somebody might be catching up with you.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of his famous sayings.
That's cool. That would have been a very cool experience. So let's go back to Washburn now. You graduated in 62, as I mentioned, so you participated in football, baseball, track, and basketball there at Washburn. You lettered at least once in all four of those sports. As far as the experience of being able to do that, I guess the biggest question for me is, how are you able to balance all the schoolwork playing all those sports too?
Well, I also had a job in the evenings, too, so that took a little bit of time. But, no, in football, the first year I was down there, I didn't go out for football, and they had me working at games, you know, helping with the footballs and the flag sticks and all of that. And I looked out there, and I said, hey, this isn't too hard. This looks pretty easy. I could play that. So I did go out my next year, which would have been my sophomore year, my first year in football.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly I was on the scout team, and I would run against the varsity on the scout team as a halfback and did fairly well. And then the next year, my second year in football, I started for Washburn and started all 3 years and was all conference 2 years after that in football.
So then you mentioned something earlier about, you know, K-State didn't have maybe a scholarship for a freshman baseball player, and I see you lettered 4 years in baseball and track there at Washburn. So was it normal for you to be able to get out there right away and be able to letter 4 years to play as a freshman and have some success like that?
Well, it worked out that way.
Mm-hmm.
I always got in track practice first, and it was kind of strange. I'd go up to the track and do most of my workout on my own. And then when I saw the coach coming out to get organized, I'd just go on over to baseball practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I did most of my original workouts by myself and then baseball as the team.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out well for us. And one of the things, in the 4 years, I started all 4 years in baseball, and in 4 years, there was only one time that there was a conflict in scheduling with a track meet on the same day as a baseball game. And the game, baseball game was at Wichita, And I told the track coach, I said, "Coach, I think I'll go to the Wichita for baseball." And he kind of nuzzles up to me in a friendly, joking way and says, "Well, John, I just want to remind you your scholarships for football and track." I went to the track meet.
Yeah. You decided I want that money to stay coming in, right? That's good stuff there. We're talking to John Bingesser, Cocker City native, had a great career at Washburn, and I think a lot of people know the coaching accolades and career that he's had. We'll get into that here momentarily, but you were inducted into the Washburn Hall of Fame then in 1981. How big was that, and how much did that mean to you after spending so much time there in Topeka and having success to be able to be a part of that Hall of Fame?
That was very exciting, and it just was something that I'll always cherish and remember. That was probably the most famous Hall of Fame. I was in five Hall of Fames, and Washburn was the first one, and then, well, that wasn't really the first one. I was inducted into the Shrine Bowl Hall of Fame in 2007. Of January, and the Kansas Wesleyan Hall of Fame in October of 2007, and then the Kansas State High School Activity Association Hall of Fame in 2016. Mm-hmm. Also at Sacred Heart, they have a Hall of Fame, which is a wall of fame, and I was put into that in 1981. So that's, I've been very fortunate and lucky, I guess, to be selected in those organizations.
So now, after that, you end up being an administrator, a teacher, and a coach, and everything else. You know, you've done a lot of different things. At what point did you decide, because we're going to start talking about the coaching career, but what point did you decide maybe that might be something you wanted to do is coach and teach?
Well, it would have been after my junior year in college, or my sophomore year, because I went the first 2 years and didn't really know what I was going to do, mm-hmm. just took general courses, and then... In my junior year, I started in the education curriculum in order to be a teacher and a coach.
So you start out, you know, just kind of looking at the bio, it looks like you went to Palco for a year and then spent a few years at Solomon. And then Sacred Heart is where, you know, you probably became most known for what you were able to accomplish in the high school football world. But what were those first few years like there at Palco and Solomon, just kind of getting your feet wet?
Well, at Palco, it was my first coaching job. I was head football and head track coach, assistant basketball. And I was there 2 years. The first year, we were 4-4. And the second year, we were 1-7, I think. Not too good. And then I went to Solomon for 4 years at Solomon from 1964, 65, 66. And 3 years, I guess, at Solomon, mm-hmm. head football and track coach and assistant basketball. We had some good teams at Solomon. They didn't have playoffs yet at that time, but we went undefeated 1 year. And then the next year, we only lost one game. So it was a good situation there. I enjoyed that. And then in 1967, they kind of recruited me to come over to Sacred Heart as a math teacher, PE teacher, and a guidance counselor. And... had really good years there. I served 14 years, won three state championships, and things just turned out real well for me. I was really blessed to have good kids, and it was just a nice place to be to coach.
Yeah, digging into Sacred Heart just a little bit more. You're 98-41 in those 14 years, as you said, three state championships. You made the playoffs six times there, and that was, in fact, the first 2 years, like you said, there were no playoffs. So you actually, the first year they had playoffs, won a state championship in 1969. What was it like back then to finally get, like, I guess, a playoff system and to be able to kind of run through? And you only had two rounds back then in 2A, but what was it like to be a part of that new transition, I guess, into the playoffs there in 69 and winning that state championship?
It was very good. I was hoping they would have had it the year before because we had an outstanding team the year before that. But then that first year, we did have a fine team, had some big kids, some strong kids, and we played tough football. And in the playoffs, it was two games where we won decidedly, and it was just good to get started. Hey, the first year they had playoffs.
Yeah, Conway Springs, you beat them 40-8 in that championship game in 69. 74 wasn't quite as easy for you, was it, there in 2A? Trigo, you beat them 28-27. That season, probably a memorable one for you as well, and I'm guessing that was a memorable state championship game.
Yeah, it was. I had not as big a team during that period of time, but I had some outstanding players. Mike Sheehan was my quarterback, and he was named the All-State quarterback on the Topeka Daily Capital All-State All Classes. He was just an outstanding ball player in all sports. So that was a great win for us out there at Waukini in the frigid, cold weather that we had the lead, lost the lead, came from behind in the last minute and a half on a 65-yard pass play from Shan to Jimmy Otto to win the ball game.
That's one thing that people probably don't think about nowadays, too, is because all the state championships are at neutral sites. Is it different to have to go on the road? What was the atmosphere like in a game like that where you're trying to win a state title at somebody else's place?
Well, the atmosphere was good for us because we had a great following no matter where we went. And even though it was so cold, our bleachers were full. Mm-hmm. And it was just a really cold, frigid day out there that afternoon.
It's kind of fun to just go back on these. You beat my alma mater then. I wasn't alive, but my dad probably might remember that. But we're talking with John Bingester again, legendary coach, Cocker City native. 3A in 79, you won that one. And that's when, you know, Coach Bardo was probably just starting to get things rolling there at Smith Center. You beat them by 8 in the 3A state championship game. And obviously we know what became of Smith Center after that. But what were they like then in a game like that in 79?
They were a good football team. I was a little leery about going up against them, but kind of the way the ball game started, they kicked off to us, went in the end zone, and moved the ball out to the 20-yard line, and then our first play of the game, we went 80 yards on a pass play from Greg Strecker to Randy Klaus and scored the first touchdown and then kind of held on to it. Smith Center did score their last play of the game and to get their 13 or 14 points, whatever they had. But it was a tough ball game. It was a fun game. Weather was nice out at Fort Hays State football field. So that was a very good win for us.
We're going to come back to Kansas Wesleyan here in a moment. But, you know, get back into high school coaching at Beloit and St. John's Tipton, but maybe, you know, the Sacred Heart teams, was there any team in there that, you know, you won 3 state championships, but you had 6 playoff appearances. Was there any team in there that you think maybe, that team probably was good enough to do it, but just something didn't go right for you?
Probably in 1976 or 75 or 76, where Mike Shan's brother Steve was our quarterback. He had an outstanding season, throwing for 8 touchdowns in 1 playoff game. And we got beat by Ellenwood to keep us out of the playoffs that game, or maybe that was in the first round of playoffs. Don't remember for sure. But that was a real good team. And then, as I mentioned before, the team before they started playoffs that I had in 1968 there was an outstanding team, had good football players. 2 or 3 of those went on to play in Big 8 football at that time.
So you have the 14 years there at Sacred Heart, and then does Kansas Wesleyan call you? How does that all work out that you ended up going to the college ranks there from 81 to 84 with Wesleyan? Take me through the process of how that happened, and I'm sure with all the success you had at Sacred Heart, it was probably tough to leave that.
It definitely was. I had to dwell on that quite a while. I did inquire of the job, and then they visited with me and eventually offered me the job, and then I had to make up my mind. And I knew if I stayed at Sacred Heart, I'd have an outstanding team the next year, because Pat Mears and some of those players were coming up. So I did go to Kansas Wesleyan. I wanted to try the college coaching out. And it was very good. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the recruiting. The first year, we had a fairly good season. And then my second year, we win the KCAC conference and go 8-2 on the season. So then the next couple of years, I ran into a little trouble with recruiting and getting kids into school there at Kansas Wesleyan. So they didn't go as well as the first two, but it was a very enjoyable experience of coaching at the college level.
So is that the biggest difference for you then, just finding your own kids? Otherwise, X's and O's were pretty much the same, you think?
Yeah, I ran the same plays
mm-hmm.
That I had in high school, and I ran those at Beloit, and I ran those at St. John's, the same mm-hmm. plays I had. They've been very successful for me. So I enjoyed the recruiting. I enjoyed going into those high schools down there in Texas and Oklahoma and talking to the coaches, and then they would round me up some kids to visit with. And I got a lot of kids out of Texas that were really, really good athletes and helped me. And then the school changed some rules on their payment plans
mm-hmm.
for kids coming in. Used to be they could come to school and then a little later on pay one-third of their fees, but they started charging them one-third of their fees up front before they could go to class. And I lost a lot of kids there. In that respect, that didn't get in, that were very good football players. So
mm-hmm.
we kind of went downhill a little bit after that, but it was still enjoyable coaching.
So as far as I know, you know, looking at your bio here, after 84, you kind of took a break from coaching as far as the football was concerned, you know, at the higher levels there. I know you moved to Beloit late 80s, and at 2002, you kind of took over the football program there. You made it to playoffs one year there in 2005. What can you tell me about the time in Beloit, just from a specific, I guess, football and maybe administration athletic standpoint while you were there with the Trojans?
My job was assistant principal and athletic director at Beloit High School for those years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the football coach job opening there, I inquired, and they said, yeah, if you want to do it, okay. So I did it for 4 years. Beloit is a good place to coach. I really enjoyed that. We had some good teams. One of the players that I stand out in my mind is DJ Fullhaig.
Mm-hmm.
He was a running back, started out as a quarterback and became a running back, and was probably one of the best running backs, if not the best, that I have coached in high school. Now, most all my other teams at Sacred Heart, we had outstanding passing attacks
mm-hmm.
that got recognition across the state. Most of the time, we had more yards passing than we did rushing. But actually, we only passed about 25% of the time, so my passing game was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed the coaching at Beloit High very much.
So, again, you had the 3 years there, and then you have a year off, and then as far as coaching is concerned, then you go to St. John's Tipton. They're looking for a coach there, and you had 3 years there, a very large amount of success, 26-4. You made it to the sub-state championship game in 2009 against a very good Hanover team. Those 3 years and eight, man, what was the difference for you moving to that level of football? Was there a lot of difference, or did you just kind of adapt?
Well, there was a little difference because there weren't that many men on the field,
mm-hmm.
but as far as what we did, I just used my same playbook. However, I took away two tackles and one of the backs and run the same plays and called them by the same names. They were the same plays I used in college, the same plays in high school at Sacred Heart. And how I got those plays is I had seen a book about a team in Arizona that run something similar. And for every morning, for several mornings during the summer, I drew up a playbook, and I probably could have sold that playbook, but I didn't.
Yeah.
But it was some good plays that worked for me over the years. And a little sideline of it, one of my coaches one of my football players that I coached at Sacred Heart went to Pratt as a junior high football coach, and he just used my playbook. And I think he said for 5 or 6 years he went undefeated, just using the exact same plays
mm-hmm.
as we did in high school. So that was a good benefit for me.
So obviously we've gone over a very successful coaching career that you've had in the sport of football, but you've also coached in basketball. You were an assistant coach at Sacred Heart for four state championships that they won at the basketball court, and you spent a year as a head coach at St. John's Tipton as well, and I know you've coached some other basketball spots as well, but what are some of the memories, I guess, that you have from coaching basketball, being an assistant or head coach, whatever it be, maybe that rival some of your football memories?
Well, I was assistant basketball coach all the years that I coached football. And at Sacred Heart, the head coach was Bob Manabaugh. And he and I complemented each other very well. He was my assistant in football, and I was his assistant in basketball. And I had complete control of the freshman class and the JV, and he took care of the varsity. But we worked together on it with all the kids in practice. And it was just a great experience to work with Bob and to work with basketball at Sacred Heart. So that was good. And then at St. John's, they needed somebody to fill in basketball. So I did that. And we went, I think, 20-2. Mm-hmm. We lost the first game of the year and then the last game of the year.
Yep. That year.
And that was... a good year. I really felt that year we should have gone all the way. We
sure, yeah.
should have, but we got tripped up there up at Rock Hills,
mm-hmm.
and then the first quarter is what killed us up there, because we got behind about 8 or 9 points at the end of the first quarter, and then had to struggle all the rest of the game to get back within 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. I remember that game for sure up there in Mankato for that one. So obviously a great career coaching and a great career playing athletics, and your career's not over in athletics, is it? You just keep going to these senior games. How many national championships have you won at the senior games? Do you know off the top of your head?
Yeah, I've won three.
Okay.
Three national championships. I've been on the leaderboard stand in probably 6 or 7 events in all of the senior games I've gone to since way back 2002 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had 3 championships in the triple jump 3 different times.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been my best advance, although I've done second in long jump, second in discus, second in javelin in several of those games. So I really enjoy doing that too. I enjoy the competition aspect. And I enjoyed as I did when I was coaching.
Mm-hmm. But the senior games, too, you go to a lot of different places, don't you? It's not always in the same spot, is it?
No, that's true. It's
yeah.
been at Louisville, Kentucky, San Francisco, Albuquerque, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
It gets me around to different places.
Yeah, so you get a chance to, you know, kind of enjoy that and while you're traveling, kind of check out some sites and things like that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know you always send us the results. How did you get started? When did you find out about the senior games, and how did you get started in that? That's kind of interesting to me.
Well, I kind of knew about it all the time, but you had to be 50 years old before
sure.
you could be in it. But before that, even out of college, I was competing in master's track
mm-hmm.
and AAU that had summer meets and stuff like that. So I really never did stop my competition over the years, just to continued somewhere.
Yeah, yep. So, you know, the coaching is in the blood, and you planted the seed, I know, for at least one of your children. John is coaching volleyball there at Highland Community College, was just this past season's volleyball coach of the year in the KJCC Duco Conference. But how proud are you of your kids and what they've gone on to do? And John kind of taking over, John the second taking over that coaching gene.
Oh, he's done really well. I just enjoy going up and watching his girls' team play. They've won over 30 games 2 or 3 years in a row, and 2 years in a row he's lacked the one game of going to the national tournament,
mm-hmm.
which hopefully this coming fall, if the season get underway, he'll be able to accomplish that. But he's had some outstanding teams up there at Highland JUCO. He's taken... Hoisington to the state tournament mm-hmm. 2 years. when he was coaching in high school. He also coached at Salina South volleyball. So I'm real proud of him. My youngest is a daughter, Brittany. She's been involved in sports all the time through high school and everything. She graduated from dental school and is now a dental surgeon and dentist in the Overland Park area. So she's done really well also.
John Bingesser with us here. It was interesting for me to kind of just go through. I knew a lot about you because I've covered a lot of your teams, but, man, there's a lot that goes back that I didn't even know about, and I hope people learn a little bit more about it and know what kind of success you've had, and I know that you've enjoyed every minute of it. What are you doing right now with the pandemic going on? You staying healthy?
I'm staying healthy, but I'm still working hard. I'm working harder now than I was when I was teaching. I'm feeding greyhounds. Greyhound racers.
Really?
And we have a farm. I'm working with the lady down at Abilene. And we have, right now, we've got 16 or 17 greyhounds on her farm that eight of them are pups that we're just getting ready for the track. We're hoping they're going to be racing here in about 8 or 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really enjoying that because that's competition.
Exactly.
And we got to get those dogs trained so that they can run. We had 7 at the racetrack over the last couple of years, but right now there's only 2 of them left there, and the others have been petted out or come home that didn't quite make it or had their usefulness done. But they will go into the pet program.
Mm-hmm.
But that's interesting to me, and it's been a lot of fun doing that. So that's my second career now.
There you go. Whatever. Always working. Always have that competitive edge, right?
That's right.
Yep. John Bingesser from Cocker City native and a great coaching, playing, and athletic career, and maybe a great greyhound career coming up for John Bingesser as well. So, John, we certainly thank you for taking the time to join us. I've enjoyed this, and hopefully you've enjoyed reminiscing about some of the things you've done in the past, and I hope everything goes well for you in the future.
Thank you, Dusty. Thank you very much.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.